Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Warriors 6.5 FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery.
I'm Al Warren.
Mr. John Copenhaver's there. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Al?
I'm delicious.
Oh, great. That's a very good thing to be right before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, delicious. Spread on bread. No, actually, you know, I'm not doing Thanksgiving.
Oh, no.
No, I'm up in the Kanakistan.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's
right. So I've got a turkey, but I'm not going to do it. I'm just too tired.
Yeah, it's kind of an ordeal. We do it. Well, I mean, if I'm being honest, my husband really does it, and I just eat clean up.
Which means you throw away the paper plates.
Well, sometimes, yes.
Truth comes out. And, of course, you can't wear white because it's after Labor Day.
Indeed.
I was just told that the other day, and I didn't realize that was still a thing, and people still said it.
Yeah, you know, I get conscious about wearing white after Labor Day. Like, not a white shirt, but, like, really, like, you know, white pants. Or not that I have a lot of white pants, but, you know.
Yeah, I think it's part of the gay gene, right?
Yeah, we're very observant of Labor Day.
Yeah, you don't need a calendar. All of a sudden, it's Labor Day. Oh, no more white. Start hacking it away without even thinking. I know it happens all the time. Well, anyway, speaking of white and Labor Day, we're going to go on to a writer. We've got a writer, another friend of yours, I guess. Now this one, and the book here we're going to focus on is called The Quarry Girls, and it's a thriller. So hold on to your seat. This is a thriller. And the author is here, Jess Laurie. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. So if you are delicious, I am spicy.
Oh.
And we know John's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
See? So sweet. Yeah, it sounds like sweet and sour pork. Anyway, I'm going to get in trouble for that, but that's okay. Jess, it's really good to meet you. So you've been writing for quite a while, or is this fairly new for you?
My first book came out in 2006, and The Quarry Girls is, I think, my 23rd. So I have been doing it for a while, but I've just been doing it full time for a little over a year.
Wow, that's quite a 26 in. Well, it's been a few years, I guess. Hey, that's still
right. We're not going to match that one, but it's been a few years.
Still, that's impressive. I'm such a slow writer. I couldn't imagine it.
You know, I think slow is better in most things. For me, I think it's a little bit of. I don't want to say addiction because that's too strong of a word, but I get so much of my mental health from writing that I just sort of, I just slam it.
I'm much the same. I'm on writing book 29 and 30 right now.
Congratulations.
Well, I don't think of it that way. I just think it's work to me.
Yeah.
But it's like you, I need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not doing it, it's crazy.
I bet, John, is it the same for you? I mean, so you're a slow writer, but do you also feel like you're missing something when you're not writing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I go a little nuts. I get grumpy and unpleasant to be around. I mean, it's funny you were saying that it's a big part of your mental health, and I feel like yes, and it's actually a big reason for my mental health to not be so good at times.
But it's true.
But, you know, I think it's mainly the flip side of it. It's the external part of the book world, not the actual sitting down to write it. I think that is, for me, therapeutic in ways that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Publishing part of the book is of a book is never the best part for me. If I can avoid it as much as possible, I do. You know, like the editing process we have to go through and all that. But it's not my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And even though I love writing, I also hate writing. It's like pushing water uphill. But when I'm done with it, it's the best feeling.
Yeah, and I can relate to that. But then I wonder if you also have an emotional connection with this writing, the writing itself. It doesn't matter what you're writing. And I mean this in the sense that you have to be connected and in the right frame of mind in order to be doing it. Or can you just do it without that?
I can't. And in fact, I have a TEDx talk about how I write, and I take a bit of trauma or some area that I'm trying to evolve in, and I put it into the main character of every book I write. And so it becomes a very personal journey, which makes it, I think, more rewarding, but also just really hard. And then especially and it's true, I think, of any book, but when you put yourself consciously into the characters, when you put it out into the world and anybody with a Kindle can download it and tell you what they think of it, it becomes a fun game.
Well, I was going to say that's a very vulnerable position to be in with a lot of people you don't know. What gives you that kind of courage?
You know, I don't know that it's courage. I think it's really as a result of growing up in a very stifling, very unsafe Midwestern home and community where people just didn't talk about stuff. And so I have all of this pent up need to tell stories. And I'm not a very good oral storyteller at all. I think that's a gift. I love people who can tell a story well in person. But if you give me time alone in front of a computer and I can craft the words how I want them to show up, it becomes something really important to me, even if I don't get it right. And I don't very often get it perfect, but it becomes a way to connect with people, honestly.
Well, the connection's probably more important than getting it perfect.
Yeah, right. And even what would that mean? What does that mean to get it perfect with writing when you've got 80 to 90,000 words? I don't even know what that would look like.
Yeah. I mean, I have this conversation with myself a lot. I have no idea why I think I'm trying to achieve like some goal in my mind with, I mean, I'm talking about sentence level stuff. I'm like, stop, John, just write.
Yeah.
And it is, I think it's a problem, but it's not a problem that I'm necessarily solved for myself. If that makes
sense. Yeah.
Maybe that comes in time. I think that, when I first started writing and getting published, that was very important to me. I wanted everything to be as good as possible, and that's why I went through publishers too. I want it to be beaten by editors and railed. Oh, that's a different, sorry, I'm talking about a different story. No, I want it to get, I really want it to go through the, well, I want it the abuse. I want it to be, I want yeah. it to learn. It was my way of learning, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I want it to be carried, you know, held to task. This is wrong. This is wrong. Do it this way. Do it, you know, and I want it to go through all the hard stuff. And now when I'm writing, I care so much less about that than I used to. I mean, I want it to come out correct and I want it to be edited properly and all that stuff, but it's not as much a focus anymore. It's moved down on the list.
Well, and I wonder how much, because it sounds like you sought out really good editing, really strong feedback. I wonder how much of it is you've internalized a lot of that, so you just don't need it as much anymore. It's part of how you write.
Yeah, I think it's a combination deal. I think I find that I can do better now when I look at things and as I write things. Sometimes I think, wow, geez, I can do that. And yeah. Whereas I didn't have that confidence 10 years ago, let's say. Yeah, and I did actually. I found an excellent editor that worked for two different publishers, And I use her all the time, no matter what publisher I'm sending it to, no matter who gets it. I go through her personally and pay her to work with me on every book I do now. So
I've done the same for 23 books, the same woman. What's the name of your woman?
We've been had.
Same person.
Yeah, no, mine's Kat. Kat McCarthy.
Okay, mine's Jessica Morrell.
Okay, so unless they've got dual names, no. No, and I found it's really important because if you connect with an editor, it's amazing how it works. And yeah. They get to know kind of the trope, kind of the things you do and the things you don't do. And it's kind of, I think it's great. I think we've done amazing work together over 20 books, I would say. And I'll keep doing it as long as she keeps doing what she does. So.
Yeah.
Those relationships, you know, writer editor relationships, if you find one it's gold, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I've been through some of the bigger publishers I worked for were, I didn't have the best relationship with some of the editors. I think coming from being on the spectrum and working through all of my own issues, sometimes editors don't have the patience, especially when I was doing The Killing Game and that book did really well. But they were really... they weren't the most pleasant editors to work with. So that was the roughest thing I've ever had gone through. And it's one of the most popular books I've ever done. So
did you just have to stand your ground, or was it more about finding compromise with that book?
I tried standing my ground, but I was too new. I think that was only, that was only my second or third book published, and I didn't feel confident. And the other thing is, I didn't feel right. I think that was a lot of it too, because you don't. Like when you've got professional editors telling you one thing, it's hard to you know, say that, oh, you're wrong, I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I guess you can say it, but it's hard to believe it, let's just say. It was for me.
They'll listen to you, right? You know, I mean, even if you speak up, you know, who's gonna win the battle?
Yeah. Well, I spoke up a lot, and I did cause quite a few waves in that publishing house, and I don't think they'll ever work with me again. But it was a successful book, and things turned out all really, really well at the end. But it was one of the hardest processes I've ever been through. I think that the thing is, they didn't realize they really hurt my feelings. Not so much from correcting me, but from the way that they were doing it.
Oh,
you know,
that's an art as an editor. I think that'd be a very difficult to tell somebody what they're doing wrong without hurting their feelings. Well, even as an English teacher, John, so you and I have both, I am no longer doing it, but you and I have both been teachers, and it's really hard to criticize somebody's writing without crushing their dream.
Right. Yeah, you do have to become a very, you know, gentle and couch things with compliments and that kind of thing. And, you know, I mean, ultimately, I think if you're an editor and your goal is to get the writer or student, your teacher, to hear you, you can't just slam them with hard, like, blunt advice, because often, unless they're just used to that kind of feedback, they're not going to hear you. Mm-hmm. So a lot of wasted energy. So yeah, with my students, I think you definitely have to find a way in to get them to hear you. You know, if you care about seeing them grow, which is, I'm not sure why you would teach if you didn't, but
right.
There are those teachers, but I don't understand those teachers. But
you write about this. This is a coming of age fiction. So when I see that, I think so. And you talk about how you put a lot of yourself into the main character. So I'm imagining that this book is about some childhood trauma you had.
Yeah, with the Corey girls, and My last four books with Thomas and Mercer have been inspired by true crimes in Minnesota, and so, which is where I'm based. And so with the Quarry Girls, it's set in St. Cloud, Minnesota, which is a quarry town in the center of Minnesota, population 60,000 or so. And when I was growing up there in the 70s, there were two and maybe three serial killers operating. And it was, I was a very young child, and I have this distinct memory of being 4 years old and going to play. Just, it's the 70s. It sounds so weird now, but just in the 70s, we just would go play as very young children. And my parents were pretty much drunk or high most of the 70s. And again, they weren't alone in that, but I was out playing, and I decided to go to the grocery store, because if I'm sitting outside the grocery store, I figured somebody would give me candy. It's not a straight line of logic, but it was all I had. So I'm standing out in front of Coburn's in St. Cloud, Minnesota in 1974, and a police car pulls up, and they ask me to get into the back of the car. And at the time, like, and still to this day, obviously, you don't get into a stranger's car, but they finally talked me into it, brought me home, and said two girls had just been kidnapped, and kids can't be walking around at night anymore alone. And so nobody really talked about it other than that. It was just, we couldn't play outside anymore without an adult. And it became this care blanket that was just over everything. And so my book, The Quarry Girls, is about, it's fictionalized, but it's about those two, maybe three serial killers in the 70s and what it was like to grow up with them hunting around you in the neighborhood I lived in, which was set over tunnels. So it was an old, abandoned car factory set over tunnels. And so it became this very metaphorical, but also terrifying childhood location. And that's what I wrote about for the Quarry Girls.
Wow. So each time you do that, I guess that's, again, you're putting, you, when you do that, when you're so involved in the story and it's so personal to you, are you a fiction writer that creates characters that you become very intimate with? I mean this in a sense of, do you hear the voice? Do you feel them? Do you, because I've talked to a lot of fiction writers, and a lot of fiction writers will come by and they'll start describing their characters as their children or their, you know, their family, and they see them in their head. They hear their voices at night, you know, things like this. They hear the conversations. Is it that way for you too, or is it completely different?
It's not that way for me. I think that would be kind of terrifying.
I do too. I write true crime and I hear them say this. And I think, oh my God, do you wake up with a shovel in your hand in the middle of the night?
I don't hear their voices. I do get intimate with them. I'm never single. I've always got my books, but I do get intimate with them in the way that I think most writers do, which is when I'm in the midst of writing a novel, even when I'm not writing it, when I'm out in the world, I'm thinking of storylines, I'm thinking of plot twists, I'm thinking of bits of dialogue that I could work in. Every now and again, I will have dreams about, usually it's a plot knot, K-O-N, T working itself out. I'll have some dream along those lines, but they are very separate. They're very separate from me. I'm just working through some evolution. I'm just working through some personal issue, which I think we all do a little bit in our writing, right? I mean, we're writing about things that are interesting to us.
Yeah, I'm writing about murder.
There you go.
I'm working it out, you know, in my books. When you talk about the, like, you're talking about the Quarry Girls, you're talking about the storyline, what is it that you think leads you into a story?
Yeah, I mean, with this one, it was a contract.
No, you're silly. No, but what leads you into the particular story, not the deal, not the, yeah, it's a two-book deal. I'm talking like as in why the Quarry Girls, why not? There's a lot of bad things that happened in Minnesota, and especially through the years. And I'm sure that there's a lot of stories you heard over the years and have come across that you could write about or center your story on. Is there something particular about certain stories that clicks with you?
With the Quarry Girls, it was my publisher wanted another true crime inspired novel. And so I knew I would be looking for that. And then I like to have a personal connection to it. So I was searching in my past. So Unspeakable Things, which was my breakout book 4 books ago, was set in my hometown where we moved after St. Cloud of Painesville, Minnesota. And the name is too on the nose. Painesville. It was just a really terrifying place to grow up. And when I was researching Unspeakable Things, which was about a period in the 80s when seven young boys were abused and returned, and then the eighth one was abused and never returned, and it was in my hometown. When I was writing about that, I stumbled across a podcast called In the Dark. Have you listened to it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's great.
It's so good. And the whole first season is about that case in Painesville. And so I'd already written half the book when I found the podcast, and I listened to it, and it just talked about it talked about everything. It was so well researched. But maybe the eighth or ninth episode talked about this raft of crimes in the 70s, 80s, and 90s that the Stearns County police either messed up on or just sort of looked away from. And one of them was the 1974 case of the Reeker sisters in St. Cloud, who were abducted on Labor Day, speaking of wearing white, and they disappeared for a month. And for the first couple of weeks, the police said they probably ran away. It was two young girls, and they just said they probably ran away. And the mother and father plastered the town with flyers. They tried to get everybody involved. And unfortunately, the girls were found a month later in the quarries. And so I knew that was a story I wanted to revisit because I was just so connected to it, obviously in a very peripheral way, but so connected to my childhood that I wanted to come back to that story. I wanted to find justice and to figure out what that looks like when the murderer has never been found and when the parents have never been able to close that chapter. And so I really wanted to explore. I just knew I really wanted to explore what justice can look like when the laws aren't supporting you.
I don't know if there's really any justice even when they get caught.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, right? It doesn't bring anybody back.
I just don't understand when people talk about this illusion of justice for anybody involved in any of these horrid crimes that I've been through so many of them, and I don't see it ever as justice, even if the person gets caught and killed that did it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just don't feel there's any weight to that word. I think it's something we use to try to fill a hole that, you know, to move on with our life as it's changed, you know. I don't know. You know, it's just, what do you hope people take away from a book like this? Like when you go into it and it's so important to you, and other than the few that will get on, you know, Amazon or Goodreads and say, I don't know, this woman doesn't know how to write. Other than that one or two, what is it that you hope someone takes away?
With the Quarry Girls, it very specifically was important to me that what people take away is the power of talking about trauma. And so if we don't keep the secret, if we don't carry the water for the system or the people who are hurting others, I agree with you, what you said about justice, but you can find some strength, or you can at least make sure that the next generation or the people one out from your circle aren't hurt as bad. And so I really wanted people to take away the idea that we need to tell these stories. We need to talk about it. We need to not take other people's behavior as our shame. And the book has been really well received, and I'm humbled by it, because when I read reviews, which I just did the first couple of days the book came out, people were getting it. People were understanding what I was trying to do with that one.
So in a way, justice is about how we carry on.
How you build back a life, or how you break down oppressive systems. I think there's something there. I think we're teasing at it. I don't know exactly what it is. It's something I continue to look for.
Let me know when you find it.
Yeah. I'll email you.
Yeah. Send me an email.
I will.
Snapchat me when you figure it out.
Yes. Do a big Snapchat. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, I think, and I hear more of this language around, and I like it because I think there's a lot of truth to this idea of, you know, maybe there's not something you can do about a particular circumstance, but you can start looking at the system.
Mm-hmm.
The system transcends individuals and individual circumstances. But if you're not really knocking that down or changing it in any way, then you end up perhaps with the same problems over and over again.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe that's what justice is. I don't know. But, I mean, I think a lot of people, the word justice itself means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. You know, it's sometimes there's a semantics problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, in the broader.
Well, I think it's an all-in-one answer. I think it's a word people use, as in justice, it represents the punishment, you know, the person getting caught, the resolution for the victims and their families and stuff. Like, it's this all-in-one, just add water and it's done type thing.
Right.
It's just not that simple. It just isn't. That's all.
Yeah, I agree.
What do I know, you know? So with this book, so what does one of these books do for you? Like, so you know, because you put so much into it and it's so important and it comes out and now you've got, you know, you read some reviews and you're happy they're getting it. You know, people are getting what you're trying to put down, you know, so what does this do for you, do you think?
I think, well, I mean, there's the obvious answer of it pays my bills, right?
Oh, right, that contract thing.
Yeah, right. I mean, I am both a practical and a creative. The bigger answer, and I think what you're asking about, is for me, it creates coherence. And I think when we tell our stories, even if they're fiction, or maybe especially if they're fiction, we take these sort of disparate pieces and we make a coherent narrative. I think, did the two of you ever play Tetris?
Yes.
Yep. Right. And so it's like that, where all these disjointed pieces drop down. But if you create coherence, that layer disappears and you're lighter, you're freer. And putting it out in the world, I get coherence, and I get to not have to carry around things that I am so used to carrying around that I didn't even notice until they were gone.
So you can let go of it.
Exactly.
It's like embodying emotion or embodying trauma. So you don't just have to live inside. You can live. You know.
It's exactly it. Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think it's resonating with people. I think that's what good books do, is I know the books that I love, I connect with them and they resonate with me. And then I get to, even if I haven't written it, I get to see that I'm not alone and release a little bit of something.
So basically it's moving on after you've murdered these people, you can, it's your way of working through it and then moving on. You can let go of it now.
Yeah. Yes. And also feel like I am more connected, because I think that's what we all want, to be more connected to something, to each other, but also to something bigger than us.
So do you think there's, so that's, you know, we've been talking kind of on the thematic level, but do you think that there's something to actually fitting a novel together? Like, you're talking about disparate pieces falling down, you know, but also just the actual act of figuring out a plot and figuring out, like, how to balance character development, all that. Do you think that's part of the process?
I do. I think it's this delicious puzzle, which is completely engrossing. And once you finally get all those pieces in place, it's a really good job if you can get it right. I think it's something that we all must enjoy to a degree, or we wouldn't be writing.
Maybe there's a relation. I think, I don't know. I'm talking from my perspective, but the act of puzzle, that part of it, it leads to the other part. Like, I don't always see what I'm after until I've worked out the logistics. Like, somehow, like, one opens the other for me, and sometimes I'll have, like, very late stage, you know, aha moments or revelations about what I was after all along when I'm writing something.
Right. Yeah.
It was just, I love it. That's the coolest thing ever. That's my favorite.
It is. It's like a gift that you didn't even know you were getting.
I would imagine it's kind of, in a sense, you have a meaning or a subtext or something that comes out in the book that's under the story that sometimes it just comes organically.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to piggyback off of what John said, sometimes I'll even have written the book, published the book, and I'll be in an interview and somebody will say, you know, I really enjoyed this theme in your novel. And I'm like, what? That's great. I didn't even know that was there. But it's really, it's something that speaks to me. I mean, as English teachers, I always thought sort of made that stuff up. Like, what's the theme of this? Right. What's the theme of this book? But there's something to it.
What's so funny when we're teaching kids, they're always like, they're really cynical. Not all, you know, I teach high school or had for many years. I don't know. But they tend to be a little bit cynical about like the whole literary analysis, you know, pick out the theme, that kind of stuff. And I always laugh at this. They're like, that writer didn't really mean to put all that in there. I'm like, well, yes. And it doesn't mean it's not there.
Yes. Yes. And now that we're writers, we know that's the truth.
You got to be careful, but, you know, someone's going to read something into it and show up at your door.
Yeah.
You know.
What?
Like that was, yeah. It's like, you know, I saw that old documentary with John Lennon and that hippie shows up at his house and starts telling him things that he read in lyrics. Oh. And it was like, well, that means we're supposed to do this, right, man?
I don't need something else to worry about, Al.
Well, that's what I'm here for. I'm here to do this. I'm here to get you on to the next level. The next
fear.
The next contract of fear. Saw 58.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, what do you think a good book is for you?
Yeah. That I've written or that I've read or both? Does it not matter?
It could be either. Like, is there a certain thing that you consider to be a good book without even titles? It's just like you've read it and you go, man, that is really good. Or you've written it and you go, this is good. I love it.
Yeah.
You know, like, what is it? Is it the grammar, the theme, the line sentencing? Like, what exactly about it makes it happen?
You know, for me, it's a feeling, which by definition is just so vague, but it's one of those books where when you're not, after you start it, when you're not reading it, you're thinking about it and like it's a lover and you can't wait to get back to it, coupled with just really amazing sentences that don't snag you in that they stand out from everything, but they're just so beautiful that you go back and reread them over and over again. It's like a lullaby. And there's a couple writers who I know are just going to do that for me, like Isabel Allende. I just, when I start reading one of her books, it's like a relationship. And then I know she's going to have some of those gorgeous sentences in there. So yeah, a mixture of how I feel and then just some really elegant writing. It's funny because, you know, we're crime writers and crime writers are very, crime is very plot heavy, but that's not, for me, that's not what sticks with me with the book.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I mean, I think that other people would focus on plot, but I would have a similar, I think it's a voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Geez, for me, it's the best amount of money I've made. That's the best book. That makes a book good.
Yeah.
Wow.
There you go.
See, you know, come on. It's all about. So where did writing come from for you? Like, was it something you started doing when you were really young and you've always been doing it? Or did it just all of a sudden appear one day?
It was, you know, I come from a creative family. And so it's, my dad's a potter. My mother's an English teacher who also was a seamstress. My sister is a chiropractor, but was also a phenomenal painter. And if you just go back generations, my family's very creative. Creativity is valued. And so I didn't know what my place was, but I loved reading. And so I snuck into writing. I got good grades in high school in English, and I thought, I can do this. And so my very first master's thesis was a novel, and I thought it was amazing. I wrote it. I finished it in 96. I thought it was incredible. I put it out on submission and I got 25 rejections. And I was like, I'm taking my soccer ball and going home. I'm never going to write again. And it's funny because master's thesis lives in the library, right? It's all of our theses are in the libraries where we graduated. And after my first book was published, I went back there to read it. And it is so bad. It is, oh my God, it's embarrassing. It's things like, my dialogue tags were things like, she rubbed her chocolate brown eye, her chocolate brown eyes, thinking, why doesn't my father love me? So bad. It was so bad that I stole it, out of the library. But I was also teaching English at a nearby college. And so I was overcome by guilt and I returned it. But for 48 hours, I had stolen that awful, awful thesis. But so that was it. That was I tried writing. It wasn't for me. At the time, I was like, it's because everybody else doesn't understand how great I am. Looking back, it was because it was awful. But I wasn't going to do it anymore. And so I got another job teaching. I was newly married. I was pregnant. And trigger warning, I'm going to talk about suicide. It was on 9/11. My husband committed suicide. And I was 3 months pregnant with my son, who's a 20-year-old. He's fine. He's healthy. He's wonderful. But the stress of my husband committing suicide put me in the hospital. They thought I was going to miscarry. And so I was hospitalized. I couldn't escape my body, but just because for obvious reasons, but also because I was creating a human. And my therapist at the time said, you need to journal. You absolutely have to get back into writing, just journal. And I don't believe in journaling. I tell my students to do it. I tell my workshop participants to do it, but it seems very self-indulgent to just write words that you're going to put in a book and tuck away. So I decided to start writing a book again. And so my master's thesis was, I'd call it mainstream fiction, women's fiction. I started to write a mystery after my husband committed suicide. And looking back, it makes so much sense. But at the time I thought, this is all I can focus on right now. I need to, something with a plot that I know it's tied up at the end. I know we have answers at the end. I know there's, to use this word again, I know there's some form of justice in here. I'm just going to write one of those. And so I wrote my first book that was published. It was called Mayday. It was a humorous mystery. But once I saw how it could help me to survive, and I mean, that sounds really sort of overwrought, but at the time it really was to help me survive. I was hooked. I never looked back.
Was that in itself the event that gave you, let's say, the push to actually try and publish it?
I think so, because that one, I was rejected 423 times before I found an agent for Mayday. And I think if I hadn't just been treading water and that was my life raft, I would have given up. I mean, that's a ridiculous amount of rejections. What else would you be rejected at that many times and not think, this isn't for me? So I do. I think that was the push.
That's interesting. Now that, 423, so you've taken note. Did you go back and go after each one of those 423 people and and do something to them? Is this sort of one of these missing people sort of thing?
Are you trying to get the plot ideas?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out 423.
I know, so many. And this was back, so it would have been what? That would have been 2002 or three. And at that time, I was in the country with dial-up internet and a dot matrix printer. Do you remember dot matrix printers? So I'm at home printing out these query letters on my, because I don't have internet that can send email. It's just not powerful enough. So I'm dot matrix printing 423 query letters. And I just sent out 50 at a time, with the mindset that, well, if I get one rejection, that's 49 others who might pick it up. And after, 40 rejections, I'd send out another 50. And so I think a lot of them, my first published book, it has good bones, but it's not a great book, right? I mean, it's better than my master's thesis, but I can see why they rejected it. I hold no ill will toward anybody who said no to that one. And I'm grateful it got published because it got my foot in the door. It gave me positive reinforcement, which I needed to keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. That's important. So I guess you're probably like every other author, as you write more, if you go back to earlier work, you realize, or you look at it, and you probably would prefer to change some of it now.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually got the rights back to my first 12 books because they just, I mean, the first one came out in 2006. They were out of print. And I thought, I'm going to just use everything I've learned since, edit these and indie publish them. And I started reading it and I couldn't even bear to read it. I just slapped on new covers and stuck it back up. I just held my nose and here you go, world.
Take this.
Yeah.
There's some justice for you. I can see it now. My God.
Do you have a moment when you felt like, you know, I don't know, where you became more aware of what you needed to do to become a better writer? Like, I think it's a truth that we're always trying to do that. But I was just wondering, because it feels like for you, there was sort of a moment, or was it more of an evolution? Or was there a book you read or a writer you read that changed you like that?
Yeah, you know, I agree with you that it's an ongoing evolution, that as writers, we're always hopefully trying to improve. And in fact, I think that's one of the draws of writing, is that I don't think any of us ever thinks we're good or that we've learned enough. But there was, with Unspeakable Things, it should never by any rights have sold to anybody. It's about a 12-year-old girl in an abusive home in a town where boys are getting abducted and abused in a flyover state, right? It never should have been picked up, but Jessica Tribble at Thomas and Mercer picked it up, and it's in 3 years sold over 300,000 copies. And I think I'm a good writer, but I thought I might have stories that people want to hear. And so when Unspeakable Things sold so well, that was the moment where instead of trying to please everybody else with my writing, I would focus some of that toward figuring out what it was that I wanted to say.
It's so good. It's such a good book. I'm surprised you felt that way about it. But yeah, I mean, but sometimes the things that are the most kind of personal, you do feel a little more like they're not going to get accepted. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Right. Cause it's so close to the vest. It's just something that, that we don't want to share with the world. And to be fair, it was turned down by every single other editor who looked at it.
Wow. See?
Yeah. Well, I think that the thing is, what we have a difficult time with writers today is because of the internet and because of Amazon and because of the easy access and thousands of books, we judge our own writing on what's popular, what's selling, and things like that, about how many likes we get, how many star rating we have, how many ratings we do get, and things and sales, I which is probably the wrong thing to do. We have to separate ourselves from that. Because it doesn't, yeah, just because it sells really well doesn't mean it's a good book. Just because it doesn't sell well, again, it could be a really good book that just didn't have the right cover and have the right publisher and the right, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes. Or the right marketing. I mean, there, like you say, there's hundreds of thousands of books out there. It's impossible sometimes to be heard in the noise.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you can even do everything right and still luck, plays a part. And but in a lot of cases, I think it's not even just the product, it's how it's broadcast to the world. And likewise, very bad books can get great marketing.
We all know of books that are selling like hotcakes and maybe aren't that great, or books that are phenomenal and just aren't getting the attention they need.
So what's next? What's going on for Jess now?
Yeah, well, so I have a sort of a police procedural, but it's more of an X-Files police procedural coming out next, I think September 23rd is the date, with Thomas and Mercer. And I lead writing retreats all over the world. And I'm halfway through a sabbatical, but I'm right now looking at leading one in Italy next fall, and then Costa Rica a year from January.
Oh my God, that sounds amazing.
Doesn't that sound fantastic?
Yes.
Oh, I love it's all the great parts of teaching with none of the grading.
Right.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Thank you. I love it.
I know. And great locations too. It's not just like, you know, without grading. It's like without grading in Italy.
In Tuscany, right?
Right.
Oh, see, this is how it works.
Yeah.
And I'm breaking into a new genre, which I'm excited to talk about. Probably in a couple of months, I'll be able to announce that too. But I have a lot of exciting stuff in the works. Thank you for asking.
Wow. So now, contact. How do people get a hold of Jess? Do you have a website? Do you do social media? Are you on hookup apps? Like, how do you connect with your readers?
I'm worried now that you said there's probably a guy waiting outside my front step.
Well, if not, we will give out your phone number and
do it. That's such a good idea.
Yeah, let's get this out there.
No, my website is Jessica Lowry. So JessicaLowrey at JessicaLowrey.com or email JessicaLowrey@gmail.com.
Fantastic. You doing social media or you're not?
I do social media. Facebook, Twitter, as long as it's still around, or not now that they've let somebody back in, but, and Instagram. And also I'm putting my toes in the TikTok water, but I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Come on. Have fun. Get on TikTok and start dancing.
Yeah.
just start throwing your book around and dancing and get a dog and you've got it made.
That's all. Okay. I'm going to do it and I'm going to send it to you and I'm going to say, is this what you meant?
Yeah. And get John to sing something in the background.
Okay.
You know, I don't know. He can sing Christmas songs. It's close to that, right?
Oh, you don't want to hear me sing. It is not pretty. Singing and dancing, like anything that takes any kind of physical coordination, it's just out. I'm surprised I can type.
Well, don't worry. The dog will be howling so loud that they won't hear
it. They won't hear it.
Not going to hear anything. Well, it's just, you know. So I have to say that being that the type of writer you are, when things over the last couple of years, like when we had, you know, the pandemic and we've had the one with the orange hair and we've had all sorts of weird things going on and, you know, stress, people protesting and all this tension in the air the last couple of years. Does that affect you when you're trying to write, especially serious fiction?
Yeah, I think if anything, it makes it more important that we take that time to be creative. I know it does for me, but I think it's true for everybody to find that quiet time, even if it's just sitting on your couch, right? And just, it doesn't even have to be formal meditation, just some time away from the noise. And so it took me a little while, especially in Minneapolis, which is where I live, and we had quite a few protests, which were important and necessary, but it was, you know, outside my window. And so it took a while to get my routine, but I was driven by, and I've been talking about that this whole interview, but I was driven by the mental health aspect of writing. And so I was able to find a routine. I still procrastinate like a monkey, but but I do have something like a routine.
Hmm. Well, and yeah, it's strange because I just wonder how much it gets into the writing, do you know?
Yeah.
Especially when you're under the contract and you're under a deadline or you've got a date and you're writing and things are stressful. I wonder if it gets a little darker in your writing.
Oh, that is interesting. My writing has gotten darker as the times get darker, but I think that's true of most writers. Even if the times don't get dark, I think the more we go on, the more we tackle some of the darker stuff. I think that's why crime fiction is one of my favorite genres, because we can really talk about stuff that matters and we can do it in an entertaining way. I don't mean light or fun. I mean a way that really grips people. And I think it's important that we do incorporate what is going on into the world into our books.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is too. I just wonder how much we'll get in that we don't realize.
Yeah, I think that's something that we'll have to have the anthropologist tell us 50 years from
well,
now.
Well, no, I just wonder if you look back 10 years from now and you read something that you're writing right now, even the Quarry Girls, and you read it then, I wonder if you would notice certain motives, certain things that you wouldn't have normally written.
You know, I did a soft deep dive into, this is about 2 years ago, and I was going to give a presentation on what sells, what is selling. And of course, it's a crystal ball. We're all guessing. But I did a deep dive into what was selling in the late 60s. So 1968, where in the United States, we had the Vietnam War. We had Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, followed by Robert Kennedy being assassinated. And it was riots, protests all across the United States. And I was very curious what books sell when people are just, either they need to escape or they need almost like that homeopathic more of what they're dealing with in controllable doses so they can adjust to it. And it was interesting. What really came up was a lot of horror, and a lot of horror was doing really well. So people were sort of turning more toward the darkness, which sociologically is interesting to me. So I think you're right. I think a lot of what we're dealing with now is showing up in ways that we can't even recognize because we're swimming in it.
I've been really interested in my students writing and what they want to write about. And it's like horror fiction or like sci-fi fantasy.
Mm.
And
a little escapism, right?
Yeah, I think living, creating worlds that are not, none of my students really want to write realism. And even when they do, it isn't quite realism. It's sort of heightened in some way.
Yeah, that makes so much sense to me.
Well, yeah, I've written a book with Peter Vronsky, who's a doctor and teaches history in U of T, University of Toronto. And I know that a lot of his theories, he talks about serial killers of the 60s and 70s, about how they were, he ties it to the relationship of World War II and the way the fathers that came home and how they treated their boys, their sons, how they didn't touch them. It was really interesting to hear that. So I just wonder if there's a lot of stuff that we do over stressful times like the pandemic and all the other stuff that we don't realize. And as this generation grows up, where will they be?
Yeah, I actually quoted that Peter Vronsky, that exactly what you just talked about in the Corey Girls author's note, because it's just fascinating to me how cultural forces, of course, shape the next generation in ways that we do not know until the check comes due.
Right. Yeah. He's been a very good inspiration for me. Good friend over years. Nice guy. I was really lucky to come across him. Yeah. He helped me write my very first book. It was the second one published, but he helped me write it. So he's a co-writer. So there you go.
Nice. Full circle.
Small world.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a thrill. I'm glad you had the time to come on our little show.
And it was an honor to be invited. I've absolutely enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
Well, and thank you. You know, now the book people need to pick up because she needs to get paid.
Right.
The Corey Girls, and it's a thriller. And Jess Lowry, she's the writer and our guest. And, you know, she needs Christmas money. So thank you for being on the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jess.
Thanks, John.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.